Doomsday Book, Cassette 16.
Montoya would never find the corder. And if she did, what would the message be? I went to the drop, but it didn't open. What happened? Kivrin's voice rising in panic and reproach, crying, Aloy, Aloy, why hast thou forsaken me? William's nurse made him sit up in a chair to eat his lunch. While he was finishing his stewed prunes, Finch came in. We're nearly out of tinned fruit, he said, pointing at Dunworthy's tray and lavatory paper. I have no idea how they expect us to start term. He sat down on the edge of the bed. The university set the start of term for the 25th, but we simply can't be ready by then. We still have 15 patients in Sulvin. The mass immunizations have scarcely started, and I'm not at all convinced we've seen the last of the flu cases. What about Colin? Dunworthy said. Is he all right? Yes, sir. He was a bit melancholy after Dr. Arendt passed away, but he's cheered up a good deal since you've been on the mend. I want to thank you for helping him, Dunworthy said. Colin told me you'd arranged for the funeral. Oh, I was glad to help, sir. He'd no one else, you know. I was certain his mother would come now that the danger's past, but she said it was too difficult to make arrangements on such short notice. She did send lovely flowers, lilies and laser blossoms. We held the service in Balliol's chapel. He shifted on the bed. Oh, and speaking of the chapel, I do hope you don't mind, but I've given permission to Holy Reform to use it for a handbell concert on the 15th. The American bell ringers are going to perform Rambo's When at Last My Saviour Cometh, and Holy Reform's been requisitioned by the NHS as an immunization centre. I do hope that's all right. Yes, Dunworthy said, thinking about Mary. He wondered when they had had the funeral, and if they had rung the bell afterward. I can tell them you'd rather they used St. Mary's, Finch said anxiously. No, of course not, Dunworthy said. Chapel's perfectly all right. You've obviously been doing a fine job in my absence. Well, I try, sir. It's difficult with Mrs. Gadsden. He stood up. I don't want to keep you from your rest. If there's anything I can bring you, anything I can do... No, Dunworthy said. There's nothing you can do. He started for the door and then stopped. I hope you'll accept my condolences, Mr. Dunworthy, he said, looking uncomfortable. I know how close you and Dr. Arendt were. Close, he thought after Finch was gone. I wasn't close at all. He tried to remember Mary leaning over him, giving him his temp, looking up anxiously at the screens. To remember Colin standing by his bed in his new jacket and his muffler saying, Great Aunt Mary's dead. Dead, can't you hear me? But there was no memory there at all. Nothing. The sister came in and hooked up another drip that put him out, and when he woke, he felt abruptly better. It's your T-cell enhancement taking hold, William's nurse told him. We've been seeing it in a good number of cases. Some of them make miraculous recoveries. She made him walk to the toilet and after lunch down the corridor. The farther you can go, the better, she said, kneeling to put his slippers on. I'm not going anywhere, he thought. Gilchrist shut down the net. She strapped his drip bag to his shoulder, hooked the portable motor to it, and helped him on with his robe. You mustn't worry about the depression, she said, helping him out of bed. It's a common symptom after influenza. It will fade as soon as your chemical balance is restored. She walked him out into the corridor. You might want to visit some of your friends, she said. There are two patients from Balliol in the ward at the end of the corridor. Miss Piantini's the fourth bed. She could do with a bit of cheering. Did Mr. Latimer? He said, and stopped. Is Mr. Latimer still a patient? Yes, she said, and he could tell from her voice that Latimer hadn't recovered from his stroke. He's two doors down. He shuffled down the corridor to Latimer's room. He hadn't gone to see Latimer after he fell ill, first because of having to wait for Andrew's call, and then because the infirmary had run out of SPGs. Mary had said he had suffered complete paralysis and loss of function. He pushed open the door to Latimer's room. Latimer lay with his arms at his sides, the left one crooked slightly to accommodate the hookups and the drip. There were tubes in his nose and down his throat, and op fibres leading from his head and chest to the screens above the bed. His face was half obscured by them, but he gave no sign that they bothered him. Latimer, he said, going to stand beside the bed. There was no indication he'd heard. His eyes were open, but they didn't shift at the sound, and his face under the tangle of tubes didn't change. He looked vague, distant, as if he were trying to remember a line from Chaucer. Mr. Latimer, he said more loudly, and looked up at the screens. They didn't change either. He's not aware of anything, Dunworthy thought. He put his hand on the back of the chair. You don't know anything that's happened, do you? He said. Mary's dead. Kivrin's in 1348. He said, watching the screens. And you don't even know Gilchrist shut down the net. The screens didn't change. The lines continued to move steadily, unconcernedly across the displays. You and Gilchrist sent her into the Black Death, he shouted. And you lied there. He stopped and sank down in the chair. I tried to tell you Great Aunt Mary was dead, Colin had said, but you were too ill. Colin had tried to tell him, but he had lain there like Latimer, unconcerned, oblivious. Colin will never forgive me, he thought. Any more than he'll forgive his mother for not coming to the funeral. What had Finch said, that it was too difficult to make arrangements on such short notice? He thought of Colin alone at the funeral, looking at the lilies and laser blossoms his mother had sent, at the mercy of Mrs. Gadsden and the bell ringers. My mother couldn't come, Colin had said. But he didn't believe it. Of course she could have come, if she had truly wanted to. He will never forgive me, he thought. And neither will Kivrin. She's older than Colin. She'll imagine all sorts of extenuating circumstances, perhaps even the true one. But in her heart, left to the mercy of who knows what cutthroats and thieves and pestilences, she will not believe I could not have come to her if I had truly wanted to. Dunworthy stood up with difficulty, holding on to the seat in the back of the chair and not looking at Latimer or the displays, and went back out into the corridor. There was an empty stretcher trolley against the wall, and he leaned against it for a moment. Mrs. Gadsden came out of the ward. There you are, Mr. Dunworthy, she said. I was just coming to read to you. She opened her Bible. Should you be up? Yes, he said. But I must say, I'm glad you're recovering at last. Things have simply fallen apart while you've been ill. Yes, he said. You really must do something about Mr. Finch, you know. He allows the Americans to practice their bells at all hours of the day and night, and when I complained to him about it, he was quite rude. And he assigned my Willie nursing duties. Nursing duties? When Willie's always been susceptible to illness. been a miracle if he didn't come down with the virus before this. It very definitely has been, thought Dunworthy, considering the number of very probable infectious young women he had had contact with during the epidemic. He wondered what odds probability would give on his having remained unscathed. And then for Mr. Finch to assign him nursing duties, Mrs. Gadsden was saying. I didn't allow it, of course. I refuse to let you endanger Willie's health in this irresponsible manner, I told him. I cannot stand idly by when my child is in mortal danger, I said. Mortal danger. I must go see Miss Piantini, Dunworthy said. You should go back to bed. You look quite dreadful. She shook the Bible at him. Scandalous, the way they run this infirmary, allowing their patients to go gadding about. You'll have a relapse and die, and you'll have no one but yourself to blame. No, Dunworthy said, pushed open the door into the ward and went inside. He had expected the ward to be nearly empty, the patients all sent home, but every bed was full. Most of the patients were sitting up, reading or watching portable vidas, and one was sitting in a wheelchair beside his bed, looking out at the rain. It took Dunworthy a moment to recognize him. Colin had said he'd had a relapse, but he had not expected this. He looked like an old man, his dark face pinched to whiteness under the eyes, and in long lines down the sides of the mouth. His hair had gone completely white. Badri, he said. Badri turned around. Mr. Dunworthy. I didn't know that you were in this ward, Dunworthy said. They moved me here after... He stopped. I heard that you were better.
Yes.
I can't bear this, Dunworthy thought. How are you feeling? Better, thank you, and you much improved? Of course, there is the depression, but that is a normal post-viral symptom. Badri wheeled his chair round to face the window, and Dunworthy wondered if he could not bear it either. I made an error in the coordinates when I refed them, Badri said, looking out at the rain. I fed in the wrong data. He should say... You were ill. You had a fever. He should tell him mental confusion was an early symptom. He should say, it was not your fault. I didn't realize I was ill, Badri said, picking at his robe as he had plucked at the sheet in his delirium. I'd had a headache all morning, but I put it down to working the net. I should have realized something was wrong. And aborted the drop.
And I should have refused to tutor her. I should have insisted Gilchrist run parameter checks. I should have made him open the net as soon as you said there was something wrong.
I should have opened the net the day you fell ill and not waited for the rendezvous, Badri said, twisting the sash between his fingers. I should have opened it immediately. Dunworthy glanced automatically at the wall above Badri's head, but there were no screens above the bed. Badri was not even wearing a temp patch. He wondered if it was possible that Badri didn't know Gilchrist had shut down the net, if in their concern for his recovery, they had kept it from Badri as they had kept the news of Mary's death from him. They refused to discharge me from hospital, Badri said. I should have forced them to let me go.
I will have to tell him, Dunworthy thought.
But he didn't. He stood there silently, watching Badri torture the sash into wrinkles and feeling infinitely sorry for him.
Miss Montoya showed me the probability statistics, Badri said. Do you think Kivrin's dead?
I hope so, he thought. I hope she died of the virus before she realized where she was. Before she realized we'd left her there. It was not your fault,
he said. I was only 2 days late opening the net. I was certain she'd be there waiting. I was only 2 days late.
What?
Dunworthy said. I tried to get permission to leave hospital on the 6th, but they refused to discharge me until the 8th. I got the net open as soon as I could, but she wasn't there.
What are you talking about?
Dunworthy said.
How could you open the net? Gilchrist shut it down.
Badri looked up at him. We used the backup.
What backup?
The fix I did on our net,
Badri said, sounding bewildered.
You were so worried about the way Medieval was running the drop. I decided I'd better put on a backup in case something went wrong. I came to Balliol to ask you about it Tuesday afternoon, but you weren't there. I left you a note saying I needed to talk to you.
A note?
Dunworthy said.
The laboratory was open. I ran a redundant fix through Balliol's net,
Badri said.
You were so worried.
The strength seemed suddenly to go out of Dunworthy's legs. He sat down on the bed.
I tried to tell you, Badri said, but I was too ill to make myself understood.
There had been a backup all along.
He had wasted days and days trying to force Gilchrist to unlock the laboratory, searching for Basingham, waiting for Polly Wilson to contrive a way into the university's computer, and all the while the fix had been in the net at Balliol. So worried, Badri had said through his delirium. Is the laboratory open? Backup, he had said. Backup.
Can you open the net again?
Of course. But even if she hasn't contracted the plague...
She hasn't,
Dunworthy cut in.
She was immunized.
She wouldn't still be there. It's been 8 days since the rendezvous. She couldn't have waited there all this time.
Can someone else go through?
Someone else?
Badri said blankly.
To look for her. Could someone else use the same drop to go through?
I don't know.
How long would it take you to set it up so we could try it?
2 hours at the most. The temporals and locationals are already set, but I don't know how much slippage there'd be.
The door to the ward burst open and Colin came in.
There you are, he said. The nurse said you'd taken a walk, but I couldn't find you anywhere. I thought you'd got lost.
No, Dunworthy said, looking at Badri.
She said I'm to bring you back,
Colin said, taking hold of Dunworthy's arm and helping him up.
That you're not to overdo.
He herded him toward the door. Dunworthy stopped at the door.
Which net did you use when you opened the net on the 8th?
He said to Badri.
Balliol's, he said. I was afraid part of the permanent memory had been erased when Brazenoses was shut down, and there was no time to run a damage assessment routine.
Colin backed the door open.
The sister comes on duty in half an hour. You don't want her to find you up.
He let the door swing shut.
I'm sorry I wasn't back sooner, but I had to take immunization schedules out to Godstow.
Dunworthy leaned against the door.
There might be too much slippage. And the tech was in a wheelchair, and he was not sure he could walk as far as the end of the corridor, let alone back to his room.
So worried. He had thought Badri meant... You were so worried I decided to refeed the coordinates, but he had meant I put on a backup.
A backup.
Are you all right?
Colin asked. You're not having a relapse or anything, are you?
No, he said.
Did you ask Mr. Chowdhury if he could redo the fix?
No, he said.
There was a backup. A backup? He said excitedly. You mean another fix?
Yes.
Does that mean you can rescue her?
He stopped and leaned against the stretcher trolley.
I don't know. I'll help you, Colin said. What do you want me to do? I'll do anything you say. I can run errands and fetch things for you. You won't have to do a thing.
It might not work, Dunworthy said. The slippage.
But you're going to try, aren't you? Aren't you?
A band tightened round his chest with every step, and Padre had already had one relapse, and even if they managed it, the net might not send him through.
Yes,
he said.
I'm going to try.
Apocalyptic, Colin said.
Transcript from the Doomsday Book. Lady Amani, mother of Guillaume de Very. Break. Rosamond is sinking. I can't feel the pulse in her wrist at all, and her skin looks yellow and waxen, which I know is a bad sign. Agnes is fighting hard. She still doesn't have any buboes or vomiting, which is a good sign, I think. Eloise had to cut off her hair. She kept pulling at it, screaming for me to come and braid it. Break. Roche has anointed Rosamond. She couldn't make a confession, of course. Agnes seems better, though she had a nosebleed a little while ago. She asked for her bell. Break. You bastard. I will not let you take her. She's only a child. But that's your speciality, isn't it? Slaughtering the innocents. You've already killed a steward's baby and Agnes's puppy and the boy who went for help when I was in the hut, and that's enough. I won't let you kill her too, you son of a bitch. I won't let you. Chapter 31. Agnes died the day after New Year's, still screaming for Kivrin to come.
She is here, Eloise said, squeezing her hand. Lady Catherine is here.
She is not,
Agnes wailed, her voice hoarse but still strong.
Tell her to come.
I will,
Eloise promised, and then looked up at Kivrin, her expression faintly puzzled.
Go and fetch Father Roche, she said. What is it?
Kivrin asked. He had administered the last rites that first night, Agnes flailing and kicking at him as if she were having a tantrum, and since then she had refused to let him near her.
Are you ill, lady?
Eloise shook her head, still looking at Kivrin.
What will I tell my husband when he comes? She said,
and laid Agnes's hand along her side. And it was only then that Kivrin realized she was dead. Kivrin washed her little body, which was nearly covered with purplish-blue bruises. Where Eloise had held her hand, the skin was completely black. She looked like she'd been beaten. As she had been, Kivrin thought. Beaten and tortured and murdered. The slaughter of the innocents. Agnes's surcoat and shift were ruined, a stiffened mass of blood and vomit, and her everyday linen shift had long since been torn into strips. Kivrin wrapped her body in her own white cloak, and Roche and the steward buried her. Eloise did not come. I must stay with Rosamond, she said, when Kivrin told her it was time. There was nothing Eloise could do for Rosamond. The girl still lay as still as if she were under a spell,
and Kivrin thought the fever must have caused some brain damage. And Garwin may come, Eloise said.
It was very cold. Roche and the steward puffed out great clouds of condensation as they lowered Agnes into the grave, and the sight of their white breath infuriated Kivrin.
She doesn't weigh anything, she thought bitterly. You could carry her in one hand.
The sight of all the graves angered her too. The churchyard was filled, and nearly all the rest of the green that Roche had consecrated. Lady Hermione's grave was almost in the path to the Lich Gate, and the steward's baby did not have one. Father Roche had let it be buried at his mother's feet, though it had not been baptized, and the churchyard was still full.
What about the steward's youngest son, Kivrin thought angrily, and the clerk? Where do you plan to put them?
The Black Death was only supposed to have killed one-third to one-half of Europe, not all of it.
Requiescat in pace. Amen,
Roche said, and the steward began shoveling the frozen dirt onto the little bundle. You were right, Mr. Danworthy, she thought bitterly. White only gets dirty. You're right about everything, aren't you? You told me not to come. The terrible things would happen.
Well, they have. And you can't wait to tell me I told you so. But you won't have that satisfaction because I don't know where the drop is, and the only person who does is probably dead.
He didn't wait for the steward to finish shoveling dirt down on Agnes or for Father Roche to complete his chummy little chat with God. She started across the green, furious with all of them, with the steward for standing there with his spade, eager to dig more graves, with Eloise for not coming, with Garwin for not coming. No one's coming, she thought. No one.
Catherine, Roche called.
She turned, and he half ran up to her, his breath like a cloud around him.
What is it? She demanded. He looked at her solemnly.
We must not give up hope, he said.
Why not? She burst out. We're up to 85% and we haven't even got started. The clerk is dying. Rosamond's dying. You've all been exposed. Why shouldn't I give up hope?
God has not abandoned us utterly, he said. Agnes is safe in his arms.
Safe? She thought bitterly. In the ground, in the cold, in the dark. She put her hands up to her face.
She's in heaven, where the plague cannot reach her, and God's love is ever with us, he said, and naught can separate us from it, neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor things present,
nor things to come, Kivrin said.
Nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature, he said.
He put his hand on her shoulder gently, as if he were anointing her.
It was his love that sent you to help us.
She put her hand up to his where it rested on her shoulder and held it tightly.
We must help each other, she said. They stood there like that for a long minute, and then Roche said,
I must go and ring the bell that Agnes's soul may have safe passage.
She nodded and took her hand away. I'll go check on Rosamond and the others, she said, and went into the courtyard. Eloise had said she needed to stay with Rosamond. But when Kivrin got back to the manor house, she was nowhere near her. She lay curled up on Agnes's pallet, wrapped in her cloak, watching the door.
Perhaps his horse was stolen by those who would flee the pestilence, she said, and that is why he is so long in coming.
Agnes is buried, Kivrin said coldly, and went to check on Rosamond. She was awake. She looked up solemnly at Kivrin when she knelt by her and reached for Kivrin's hand. "Oh, Rosamond," Kivrin said, tears stinging her nose and eyes. "Sweetheart, how do you feel?" "Hungry," Rosamond said. "Has my father come?" "Not yet," Kivrin said. And it even seemed possible that he might. "I will fetch you some broth. You must rest until I come back. You have been very ill." Rosamond obediently closed her eyes. They looked less sunken, though they still had dark bruises under them. "Where is Agnes?" she asked. Kivrin smoothed her dark, tangled hair back from her face. "She is sleeping." "Good," Rosamond said. "I would not have her shouting and playing. She is too noisy." "I will fetch you the broth," Kivrin said. She went over to Eloise. "Lady Eloise, I have good news," she said eagerly. "Rosamond is awake." Eloise raised herself up on one elbow and looked at Rosamond, but apathetically, as if she was thinking of something else, and presently she lay down again. Kivrin, alarmed, put her hand to Eloise's forehead. It seemed warm, but Kivrin's hands were still cold from outside, and she couldn't tell for certain. "Are you ill?" she asked. "No," Eloise said, but still as if her mind were on something else. "What shall I tell him?" "You can tell him that Rosamond is better," she said. And this time it seemed to get through to her. Eloise got up and went over to Rosamond and sat down beside her. But by the time Kivrin came back from the kitchen with the broth, she had gone back to Agnes's pallet and lay curled up under her fur-trimmed cloak. Rosamond was asleep, but it was not the frightening, death-like sleep of before. Her color was better, though her skin was still drawn tightly over her cheekbones. Eloise was asleep too, or feigning sleep, and it was just as well. While she had been in the kitchen, the clerk had crawled off his pallet and halfway over the barricade. And when Kivrin tried to haul him back, he struck out at her wildly. She had to go fetch Father Roche to help subdue him. His right eye had ulcerated, the plague eating its way out from inside, and the clerk clawed at it viciously with his hands.
"Domine Jesu Christi," he swore, "fidelium defunctorium de penos infirmus."
Save the souls of the faithful departed from the pains of hell. "Yes," Kivrin prayed, wrestling with his clawed hands. "Save him now." She rummaged through Hermione's medical kit again, searching for something to kill the pain. There was no opium powder. And was the opium poppy even in England yet in 1348? She found a few papery orange scraps that looked a little like poppy petals and steeped them in hot water. But the clerk couldn't drink it. His mouth was a horror of open sores, his teeth and tongue caked with dried blood. "He doesn't deserve this," Kivrin thought, "even if he did bring the plague here. Nobody deserves this. Please," she prayed, and wasn't sure what she asked. Whatever it was not granted. The clerk began to vomit a dark bile streaked with blood, and it snowed for 2 days, and Eloise grew steadily worse. It did not seem to be the plague. She had no buboes, and she didn't cough or vomit, and Kivrin wondered if it were illness, or simply grief, or guilt.
"What shall I tell him?"
Eloise said over and over again.
"He sent us here to keep us safe."
Kivrin felt her forehead. It was warm. They're all going to get it, she thought. Lord Guillaume sent them here to keep them safe. But they're all going to get it one by one. I have to do something.
But she couldn't think of anything. The only protection from the plague was flight. But they had already fled here, and it had not protected them. And they couldn't flee with Rosamond and Eloise ill.
But Rosamond's getting stronger every day, Kivrin thought. And Eloise doesn't have the plague. It's only a fever. Perhaps they have another estate where we could go, in the north.
The plague was not in Yorkshire yet. She could see to it that they kept away from the other people on the roads, that they weren't exposed. She asked Rosamond if they had a manor in Yorkshire.
Nay, Rosamond said, sitting up against one of the benches. In Dorset.
But that was of no use. The plague was already there. And Rosamond, though she was better, was still too weak to sit up for more than a few minutes. She could never ride a horse. If we had horses, Kivrin thought.
My father had a living in Surrey also, Rosamond said. We stayed there when Agnes was born.
She looked at Kivrin.
Did Agnes die?
Yes, Kivrin said. She nodded as if she were not surprised.
I heard her screaming.
Kivrin couldn't think of anything to say to that.
My father is dead, isn't he?
There was nothing to say to that either. He was almost certainly dead. And Garwin, too. It had been 8 days since he had left for Bath. Eloise, still feverish, had said this morning,
"He will come now that the storm is over."
But even she had not seemed to believe it.
"He may yet come," Kivrin said. "The snow may have delayed him."
The steward came in carrying his spade and stopped at the barricade in front of them. He had been coming in every day to look at his son, staring at him dumbly over the upturned table. But now he only glanced at him, and then turned to stare at Kivrin and Rosamond leaning on his spade. His cap and shoulders were covered with snow, and the blade of the spade was wet with it.
He has been digging another grave, Kivrin thought. Whose? Has someone died? She asked.
No, he said, and went on looking almost speculatively at Rosamond.
Kivrin stood up. Did you want something?
He looked at her blankly, as if he could not comprehend the question, and then back at Rosamond. No, he said, and picked up the spade and went out.
Goes he to dig Agnes's grave?
Rosamond asked, looking after him.
No, Kivrin said gently. She is already buried in the churchyard.
Goes he then to dig mine?
No, Kivrin said, appalled. No, you're not going to die. You're getting better. You were very ill, but the worst is over. Now you must rest and try to sleep so you can get well.
Rosamond lay down obediently and closed her eyes. But after a moment she opened them again.
My father being dead, the crown will dispose of my dowry, she said. Think you Sir Blowett still lives?
I hope not, Kivrin thought, and then,
poor child, has she been worrying about our marriage all this time? Poor little thing.
His being dead is the only good to come out of the plague, if he is dead.
You mustn't worry about him now,
You must rest and get your strength back. The king will sometimes honor a previous betrothal, Rosamond said, her thin hands plucking at the blanket, if both parties be agreed. You don't have to agree to anything, Kivrin thought. He's dead. The bishop killed them. If they are not agreed, the king will bid me marry who he will, Rosamond said. And Sir Bloat, at least, is known to me. No, Kivrin thought, and knew it was probably the best thing. Rosamond had been conjuring worse horrors than Sir Bloat, monsters and cutthroats, and Kivrin knew they existed. Rosamond would be sold off to some nobleman the king owed a debt to, or whose allegiance he was trying to buy, one of the troublesome supporters of the Black Prince, perhaps, and taken God knew where to God knew what situation. There were worse things than a leering old man and a shrewish sister-in-law. Baron Garnier had kept his wife in chains for 20 years. The Count of Anjou had burned his alive. And Rosamond would have no family, no friends to protect her, to tend her when she was ill. I'll take her away, Kivrin thought suddenly, to somewhere where Bloat can't find her and will be safe from the plague. There was no such place. It was already in Bath and Oxford and moving south and east to London and then Kent, north through the Midlands to Yorkshire and back across the Channel to Germany and the Low Countries. It had even gone to Norway, floating in on a ship of dead men. There was nowhere that was safe. Is Garwin here? Rosamond asked, and she sounded like her mother, her grandmother. I would have him ride to Courcy and tell Sir Bloat that I would come to him. Garwin, Eloise said from her pallet, is he coming? No, Kivrin thought. No one's coming. Not even Mr. Dunworthy. It didn't matter that she had missed the rendezvous. There would have been no one there, because they didn't know she was in 1348. If they knew, they would never have left her here. Something must have gone wrong with the net. Mr. Dunworthy had been worried about sending her so far back without parameter checks.
There could be unforeseen complications at that distance, he'd said.
Perhaps an unforeseen complication had garbled the fix or made them lose it, and they were looking for her in 1320. I've missed the rendezvous by nearly 30 years, she thought. Garwin? Eloise said again, and tried to rise from her pallet. She couldn't. She was growing steadily worse, though she still had none of the marks of the plague. When it began to snow, she had said, relieved, he will not come now until the storm is over, and gotten up and gone to sit with Rosamond, but by the afternoon she had to lie down again, and her fever went steadily higher.
This ends side one of cassette 16. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.